philosophy. 10, April 30th, 1954.
Pressed for time. So, Mr. Heavy Gatsby, I'm not going to have you read this report. What we have to finish today is the picture of the Hebrew University as exemplified in the Medical School of Salerno. Remember that we had in Paris the two river banks and two kinds of schools. The ordinary old church school, that is one bishop, one school, and the newfangled international school, interlocal, you may call it. And their combination, that is a university. Then we found in Bologna, not two river banks, but we found the emperor of north of the Alps and the Apennine and the Pale south of the Apennine clashing. We found two orders, church and empire, emperor and pope, clashing, papacy, all right, clashing on canon law and Roman law, or imperial law, you can call it, Roman law and canon law. And every student required not only here to go to a local and an interlocal teaching staff and faculty, but here to hear two opposite systems of law and to become a doctor of both laws. If you want to be a jurist, you cannot just be here a county judge as we have it. In America at this moment, law is no science. Law is a political football. There is no, the Harvard Law School is a grind. It's a factory for case lawyers, but has nothing to do with jurisprudence or science. Just training. Our law schools in this country have abolished the great status of real legislative level where things are discussed as to their merits, as to their justice. That's not done in law schools, that's done in the papers, that's done in Harper's Magazine, it's not done in law journals. Law journals deal with cases in this country. That is to say, it's very important for you to understand why America at this moment is in such a bad way that has no higher institutions of learning. Now, this third school, gentlemen, in medicine, was situated even a more strange manner at the crossroads of two worlds of medical tradition. And Salerno is the base hospital, very much as Bordeaux would be today in the case of a world war for the American troops in France. You know, Bordeaux was the base. Now, if you think of Salerno in such terms, you will see right away that Salerno is the base hospital for the Crusaders to Jerusalem and the Orient. And now the whole Middle Ages were filled with crusades. There has been a crusade going on. You can say ever since 1050 down to the day of Lepanto in 1570 when Count Don Juan d'Austria was going to the war. Who knows Chesham is spoiled? You know, that's the last battle in a crusade-like pattern, you see. Don Juan d'Austria is going to the war. That's 1570. So you have, by and large, 500 centuries in which the crusaders from all Europe took ship either in Sicily or in Salerno and then sailed through the Straits of Messina towards the Holy Land or to Greece, because the Frankish kings also at that moment time governed the peninsula which we call today Greece again with a rather artificial invention, because in the Middle Ages no Greeks lived in Greece. That's one of the most terrific restorations in the world I've ever seen, the attempt of the modern Greeks to pose as the heirs of ancient Greece. That's artificial. There's not one Greek in Greece now. But you believe it. It's the creation of American professors. Modern Greece.
hard to believe, but I knew one of these professors.
He said he brought down, when the Turkish-Greek War occurred in India in 98, he brought down the house in Berkeley, California, because he told his students that now ancient Greek liberty had to be restored, you see, on the battlefield of Thessaly. There were more Greeks in the Turkish army, so to be sure, fighting at that time than on the Greek side. These were all Albanese thieves. Well, never mind. It's a good story for the school, for the students, that there is a Greece again today. This is what I try to say is that Greece was as much as the Holy Land, as much as Asia Minor, as much as Constantinople and Egypt, the to be reached from Salerno as the base. And the sick people and the cripples also came back to Salerno as to the first friendly port where their own men could be killed. Salerno was governed by Norman princes at that time, who had, as you may know, not only conquered England in 1066, but they also in 1059 had taken possession of Sicily and Genoa, and Naples and Salerno, and the Straits of Otranto. And they had even gone as far as the Lake of Azov, the Sea of Azov, and the Black Sea. The Normans, the Norsemen, took possession of all the airlines of that time, which were the shipping lines. What we call today the air bases, you see, of the Americans, were then in the hands of the Norsemen. If you want to understand the Norsemen, they are very much like the modern Americans. Very much similar in character. They based their existence very much in the same way on trade posts and air bases, but always denied that they were imperialists. So as we do, we have all the air bases in the world more than anybody else, but we are of course no imperialists whatsoever. That's only for the bad British to be imperialists. We only defend liberty in Indochina, but the British, you see, these cowards, they are not even, they are willing to commit their empire. You saw perhaps two days ago how the roles have changed, how little imperialistic England is and how much imperialistic we are. But it must be said in this country. So in the same way the Norsemen in the 11th century in Salerno always talked very big about being crusaders and restoring freedom, that is Christianity, the freedom of Christianity all over the world, but not at all dominating the world. Oh no. Nothing imperialistic about the Norsemen, just good Christians. So we are crusaders. Mr. Eisenhower, after all, called his book Crusade in Europe, didn't he? So this is very Norseman-like, you see. Crusade in Europe, but no imperialism, of course. Why Salerno is very interesting, gentlemen. We are good in medicine, and the Norsemen were good in medicine because they had to go to war. Medicine and warfare go very close together, just as techniques, as military and hydrogen bombs and warfare go very close together. And in Salerno, there were two traditions, the Arabian tradition and the straight Greek Latin tradition. The Arabian tradition was, in fact, diluted or filtered Greek tradition. The Arabs had no medicine of their own, but they had translated the right letter, the writings of the old Greek doctors. And then there were Latin texts. So we get, so to speak, this the story in Salerno, that is taught in Salerno, is this way. Here is the old Greek Hippocrates, on which today still, as you know, every young doctor takes an oath. Then Hippocrates' medicine had passed through the pen of a man called Galenus. In the second century of our era, Hippocrates lived 400 BC, Galenus 280, and Arabian texts are by and large of 900 AD. Now in Salerno, there were brought together the Arabian texts translated from African by African Christians and brought to Salerno in the year of the Lord 1080. And that ended Latin texts which the monks could read directly from Balinus without a special translation from the Arabian. So the clash in Salerno was of the Latin and the Arabian medicine. And so every sick man could be treated by a doctor by comparing these two schools of thought and making a decision on which course he should follow. So you see that even in such a case of a mere surgical operation for a war veteran on a war veteran, these people had the liberty of choice in dubiis libertas. The physical world, gentlemen, is the arena of doubt, of constant change, and of constant misgivings about our own knowledge. And so you see the strange spectacle. Theology, dealing with the greatest secrets of our existence, with God, it has its clash quite close by between the archbishop and the freelance teachers on the other side of the river. That's dealing with the universe, with the creation of the world and the aim of the world, isn't it, theology? Now you come to medicine. Your little toe is involved, your little finger. But there's two sources which clash in Salerno, in the teaching of medicine, are a worldwide distance. One comes from Arabia, a little bit probably from India, and Greece, and the other comes from Rome. So that every one little human body is exposed to traditions, you see, that have had, that expanded, cover the whole Mediterranean world. I think it's very interesting to see that the tension, the conflict, the mental conflict on the great principles of theology can be imprisoned into two river banks, two banks of one river, same. And that's enough to illuminate the spirit, you see, to come to tremendous conflict. But in order to know what to do about your cold or your typhoid fever, these people in Salerno mobilize thousands of years or from far-fledged countries, you see, and pit them against each other. And in the law of human communities, of states, is in a medium distance. It is the north of the Alps, the emperor who comes from the north of the Alps, and the pope who comes from Rome, and they clash in Bologna. But I think it is fascinating to see how here the embodiment of conflict in three cases, you see, covers a different distance of ground in geography, in space. Can you understand what I mean? Abelard, who teaches on the left bank of the River Seine, as against the official teaching of the Archbishop School, you see, just one freelance teacher who can say the opposite on the greatest truth of the universe, you see, what revelation is, what redemption is.
Yep. Sir, is it why that you have a conflict in theology and law, or a conflict in one of the two?
In both, or in all three. You have a conflict in all three fields. I gave you an example of the conflict in law last time, didn't I, on marriage. And I said, for example, the compromise was reached finally that the church had all the things to say on the personal ways of getting married, and the state had everything to say on the material consequences of your fortune. I said real estate and fortune and money and dowry were settled by the secular part magistrates with regard to marriage, that is by Roman law or civil law or ordinance or statute of the King of England or the city of Sevilla or the city of London. But the law, rule of who could marry whom and when were you married, you see, husband and wife, had to be settled by the religious authorities. Now today I want to introduce the problem of the conflict between the medical authorities, the Arabian and the Roman. And you ask me, is there a conflict? Well, sir, there is as much conflict, because you must understand, what's your name, please, Mr. Reagan? Miller, Mr. Miller. There is no science without conflict, because the essence of science is that you have to change all the time. You see, science is not a body of knowledge, but science is a changing body of knowledge. No science, gentlemen, as you think, can be ever imprisoned in the Encyclopedia Britannica. When you buy the Encyclopedia Britannica, it's obsolete. Or the science has died. It has to be obsolete when it's commonplace. Because I try to show you that science in the state of affairs of becoming must always be ahead of common sense, of that which are already tried and known to everyone, to the men in the street.
Doesn't
always have a foundation to base that on? No. The foundation is in heaven and not in your mind and not in the common man's mind. You have to contradict common sense all the time. 20 years ago it was considered common sense that children shouldn't have maternal care. They were put away in glass, behind glass, as you know, 13 babies in one room and 13 mothers in 7 different rooms. You see? Common sense was had gone haywire. Then one man came and said, this is mad. And he began to preach against the real common sense. And now these children, as you know, are allowed to live and stay with their mothers again, which should never have disappeared. Common sense is a crazy, it is of yesterday. That's what you call common sense.
Then you're saying all the fundamental laws of science are obsolete.
What?
You're saying all the fundamental laws of science are obsolete now?
The fundamental laws of science should be obsolete.
What's right?
Well, but take quanta. You still think absolutely before Kant in your imagination. To you, you are still a negative in your whole thinking because you were born up this way. And in this sense, you know already that your thinking is obsolete because the quanta theories demands from you that you should learn to see that quantity is a quality. That five is not simply five times one, but a quality of center. Life in the universe becomes much more organic. But you still live in the universe because you drive cars, but you really think that 70 miles are just 70 more times 1 mile speed. Now, if you are honest with yourself, you know that a man who drives on a highway 100 miles an hour is not simply driving faster than a man who drives at 30, but that's a different quality, isn't it? The jump into the rain of the hand. But your mechanized thinking thinks, oh, I just increased the speed of it. You still think in pre-Kantian Newtonian terms. And that's the part of the great misfortune in this country at this moment. But you think about everything in quantum. You speak of a battleship as $40 million. That's no explanation of what a battleship is. You blind yourself when you see, when I read the headline, there was launched a $40 million battleship, it blinds you to what a battleship is. Because you try to express it in an unqualitative way. And that's right too, I told you that if you get an author on this campus, Mr. Mumford or somebody like that, and then he has to read in his paper that he's the author of 23 books. So you disparage that. Because the man who is an author of simply a list of books is not a human being anymore. An author is a man who writes a book when it is necessary to write a book. So you have 31 times, you see that the essential book, like you should say of a man, he's always a man who has written necessary books, and not a book man who has written unnecessary books. But you see, he has written 31 books, you just need to read one important question undecided. Whether it's a man who sells this seller for money or sells his mind to see to the public, or whether it's an honest man who only sells what he believes. That's the only question you can ever say or answer about an author. That would be quanta theory, you see. And that would be the modern enumeration quality. This is all Newtonian physics that obsesses the modern conversation.
If the clash in Paris illuminated the spirit of the theologians, what did the clash in Salerno do to their
faith? Exactly. Well, I'm on my way. Of course, what did? But there are always to decide in every one case, surgery and internal medicine. You can always be conservative, as the doctors call it, or you can always cut cord right and turn. In any one case, you see, in this country, you always operate. In all other countries, people say it's better not to operate. Because mended is mended, and patched is patched. And don't think that after you have been operated, all these surgical masterpieces of this country, that you are as much left of your nervous system. You are ruined for life, but you are healthy, according to surgery. That is to say, this decision is the most urgent decision again today in medicine. Is it better to have some pain and not to be operated upon? Or is it always better to take the knife? In this country, 99% of the patients want to be operated. It's interesting to undergo an operation. You all want to be operated upon. I don't. I'm against it. And a wise doctor would be a doctor, and that's the greatest conflict, you see, who in any one case is open to doubt whether there should be operation or not. Who can see that the more precious a human life is, you see, the less you can interfere with this curve by taking a limb out of such a man and making him undergo, you see, taking his attention, so to speak, upon his body. I always tell the story of my doctor in England, whom I consulted. I had to go to Oxford to give a term there in lectures, and I was in great pain. And he said to me simply, "You are a scholar." Yes. And he said, "Scholars and officers of the Army and Navy must never be under medical treatment for more than a fortnight. They are not a person to think of themselves. They go nuts if they are forced to. So I won't treat you, have your pains, and good luck." That was a doctor. And modern people are just bogs. What you call doctors. Because they are always know that they have to act. Gentlemen, obviously in medicine, as in legislation and as in the divine sphere, the only wisdom is that you know that you are free to act on it and not to act. If you have not this doubt, you haven't even learned to doubt what scientific doubt is. The first doubt is this a case for my intervention? And if you are not free to say, this is not a case for my intervention, you can never do right, really. It's accidental. And this is unknown. There's no little wisdom today in the world. Because the people, you see, many people do not know that when somebody comes to them professionally, they may be bound to say, this is not for my professional advice. When a lawyer says, for example, you come to a lawyer or a doctor and say, they say then, I, as your doctor, have to say this. You always know that you get the second best advice, because otherwise you wouldn't say that. Because if you were your intimate alter ego, you see, you obviously would give a different advice. But as your doctor, I have to say this. As a doctor, as a lawyer, for example, I can tell you, go to court. You can, you are right. As your friend, I say, don't go to court. You go nuts. It's the same with the doctor, gentlemen. As a doctor, he can operate, of course. As your friend, he must say, write your book, get married, take your trip, I mean, go on with your work and forget about it. Because the scar of the tissue in your, after the operation will last you for the rest of your life. You have never heard of this, gentlemen. Because we are living in a barbaric age, where the doctors are just plumbers, barbers, butchers. The lawyers are just quacks, or whatever we call them, I mean, non-shysters. That is, they always are functional. Gentlemen, when you can go to a man, to a lawyer, a doctor, a theologian, and because he is, you are his client, force him to act, he has given up his freedom. If by your paying him $20 for a fee, you can force a man to marry everybody, he certainly has given up the right to administer the sacrament of marriage. Because that would be a minister who says to 10 couples, I'm sorry, I'm not going to marry you. You are just running straight into hell. And I'm not going to give you a blessing on the church to this unholy undertaking. No, but since you are willing to pay $20, they say, I'm delighted. More, give me more of them. Every minute. You see? That's just funny. That's why the church, of course, is no good. It's the same as the law. You can go to a lawyer and say, I must go to court. I'm angry. I'm furious. This is my enemy. I want to put him down. And if the law, you can force a lawyer because you pay his fee to act for you, he's a shyster. Because he's no longer free. He no longer represents anything important, any decision. He's just, you see, your servant, nothing else. He can serve your passions. Like the, well, you see it from all the rich people who can afford to go to court on everything. I mean, the lawyers always play a critical role in such trials. We had such a trial right now in California, haven't we? And with the doctors, it's the same, gentlemen. The freedom, the dignity, the higher rank of a profession, what we call a profession with a medieval term still, gentlemen, is this is a man who is himself responsible for the decision to act or not to act. Now, to give you a topic, this is therefore universal, sir. In Salerno, as today, the question was always, should the sanctuary prevail or the belief in the nature of things? And then you get to always the opposite, two schools. One is action, this is the American school. Act. And the other is wait and see. That takes great much more weight of character for the doctor, you see, because it's no spender in it, and he can charge for an operation $5,000, but for his wait and see policy, which takes much more nerve on his part, he can hardly charge pay. So his family starves, so he better become the same. Operates all the time, you see, gets very rich, high great esteem in the community, you see, and is not rated as a crackpot who says, to a sick person, like go to bed and wait. In most cases, the only way to treat. So they shoot them with all these medicines, you see, penicillin, and so on. Just the victim of it, myself. And cardiac methods, that's just a substitute for in that very action by surgery. You all believe it, that giving medicine is better than giving no medicine. The doctor begins, obviously, only when he is absolutely indifferent to giving a drug or not giving a drug, and when he decides on the merit of the case, whether it is not better in this case to force this man to see that he can reach a doctor. Think of all the psychopaths who must get their drug. Would it be much more impressive if the doctor said, now I go to prove to you that you can get well without all these drugs?
No. Did you say that was a conflict in Salerno?
Oh yeah, because you had the two, the surgeon, the bar, and they're called that, the surgeon in the old world, and the real doctor. And in the Middle Ages, of course, the dignity was with the men who did not operate. The operator, the operator opposite was prevailed at that time. The surgeon was lower than him. And the man who did not operate was a high priest of medicine. Today, this surgery is the opposite, you see. We take our room from the dentist. The dentist runs highest, and the surgeon comes second, and then the real doctor comes third in your public esteem.
Sir?
Yeah?
Was the Latin surgeon or the Arabic surgeon?
No, the Arab surgeon and the treatment was both. The surgery, of course, came down by practical apprenticeship and not much literacy, you see. I mean, that is routine. That is like blacksmithing, you see. You may
you may compare the surgeon of the Middle Ages to an experienced blacksmith. That is, the operation had to be taught from master to apprentice, and that doesn't come from books. No, where there are some descriptions of operations, you see the medicine is very old and highly developed already. 3000 BC, people had skull operations of high standing. They had circumcision, they had ribs, they had artificial limbs. You see, they had already the pin to put back again an arm or a shoulder, you see. So you must think that very different from what you think. Medicine is a very ancient and highly developed art. 3000 BC, you find in the graves of primitive men already people with trepanation, that is, with the blood clots taken out of the skull after battle, after wound. And all this, of course, was handed over from guilds, so to speak, in crafts, you see, from apprentice to the apprentice by the master. But it wasn't so much literary, you see, but it was done. People simply watched operations and then were allowed to do it themselves. No, the great battle which the Middle Ages really filled was the fighting of epidemics. Again, you have a hard time to understand this because, as you know, we pollute our rivers. And that's what they could do in those days where they had no injections of individuals, no vaccination, was to keep the water pure. And the medical school of Salerno had a tremendous influence all through Europe, and you may see that already in the year of the Black Death in 1347, which ravaged Europe, there was established agreement on the rules of immunity or of cleanliness or of not polluting the water, of isolating people, of burning the corpses of the dead, of fumigation, that what we would call today sterilization, you see. And you would be surprised to learn, must be surprised to learn that in 1350, by and large, as a discipline of any community with regard to the plague was tremendous. And these measures were publicly and socially enforced. That is, gentlemen, what we today rediscover as hygiene or public health, that was really the result of the public teaching in Salerno, the discussion of medicine. The treatment of the individual, not only, you see, was cared for, but the rules of preserving a minimum of purity in the community, in the commonwealth. The pollution of rivers, gentlemen, again is an old story. In Persia already, in antiquity, this, as you know, was considered such a crime that people were executed who polluted the river. Well, I don't know how many Americans then would have to be executed. Gentlemen, it is a great indictment against our land that the waters here are polluted. It's terrible. You see what a shoddy role, again, medicine plays. It's a money-making proposition, but it doesn't govern the country's spirit. Despite all the lip service you pay to medicine, our industrialists are still allowed to pollute our rivers and pollute the air. Just go to Pittsburgh. This was not done in the Middle Ages because, of course, the conditions of life were so scanty and people were so compressed within the framework of small towns with walls and fortifications around them, with one or two pumps, wells, serving them, you see, as supply, that they had to ration the water and they had to ration the use of the water very carefully. So they always lived under a kind of austerity program. But you have a very wrong conception because you think of the past as a dirty, unsterile, bacteria-rife barbaric past. That is not true. Gentlemen, the discipline, which, for example, even the Puritans observed in a small city like Boston, is remarkable. They couldn't have survived a year without such things. No litter. Everything you see around our cities did not exist in those days. What you take for granted as dirt and in lack of discipline, our slums around our cities, when you drive into any town and you first come to these dirty outskirts, that was strictly forbidden in those days. Didn't exist. You couldn't, because people would have just died like flies. It's the other way around from what you think, gentlemen. There has never been such a degeneracy in the anarchy in public hygiene as in this, as it is now in this country to be seen, and you drive into any one big city. And the way you show around your litter is just indescribable. This is a prejudice which you have to fight, gentlemen. You are accustomed to look down to not only to the dark ages, but to the dirty ages. Now, certainly they have no prejudice. And it was much more difficult to be pure. But I get a description these days from Spain. Spain is certainly one of the purest countries in the world at this moment. It's as poor as any Asiatic or other country can be. And yet the cleanliness of the people, as my wife writes me, is simply surprising. And she said this just is so much in evidence. The first thing you feel is these people are in rags, but in clean rags. They're very, very clean. And without plumbing, you can see that this takes a tremendous discipline. Very difficult to achieve. So don't be betrayed. There is a medical tradition in mankind which is much older than what you call Mr. Pasteur and modern medicine from 1880. That's where you take your so to speak, life expectations from. And I wanted to say this because it's perhaps the most outstanding feature, that the discussion of the rules of how to fight epidemics in cities, in communities, that this discipline is the fruit of the teaching of the medical school of the Middle Ages. And that you had a public health service ever since, you see, was established in those days. That people just had public health officers. That, for example, there was taken care that the dead were buried. Even in the Black Death, if you read Boccaccio, have you read Boccaccio? Will you remember that this is told during the epidemics of the Black Death, where the real problem was just simply to get people to bury the dead? That is a serious problem. So, Mr. Miller, are you satisfied?
Well, not so early.
No? What's your question?
I want to know, was there just this conflict in the study of law, or was it in all three fields? Was this the center of conflict in the whole discussion?
But if you have two complete sets of rules from two opposite sources, and that if every one issue has to be discussed from opposite authority, can't you see that the constant conflict? I'll give you an example. The 13th century established the great right of resistance. As you know, the American Revolution and the English Revolution are based on the right of resistance. Well, that is formula which didn't exist in antiquity. Plato has not known of a right of resistance, right of rebellion, just anywhere else. That belongs to the Christian era. Because it is only possible when the conscience is divine. Human conscience is a creation of the Christian era. Now, the school of Bologna, gentlemen, you believe it or not,
discussed from the very first days, beginning by and large in the middle of the 12th century, the problem has a citizen the right to resist unjust laws, and has the citizen the duty to resist unjust laws. This is people's problem, as you know, with the thought of time, and to discuss that we have the whole problem of the right of resistance just 946 again. Why is that so, gentlemen? This is surprising. This comes from the conflict of two authorities, Pope and Emperor. You make a law. If you live only under one authority, you have to obey the law. And you are always on the same side if you obey the law. And if you don't obey the law, you are just subversive. And you come under the list of the Attorney General. Now, gentlemen, it may be that I don't come under the list of the Attorney General. I'm not so sure. I have never declined to be a communist, but obviously I'm a counter-revolutionary, I'm a reactionary. But when it comes to the state telling me what is the message, I'm inclined to feel some itching and to say, as a member of the church, I'm not going to be told by any attorney general what's the message. Because that's a communist message.
Oh yes, the government can be subversive. It can be used. Taxation without representation wasn't charged to serve subversion of the liberties of America. This country is based on the assumption that the crown, the British crown, went wrong.
All our title to our own existence is based on the assumption that the king did wrong. Because he taxed us without representation. That's subversive government.
Seems a long time ago for you. You are so complacent and so love dictatorship so much by the government that the government can do no wrong. And you all join the FBI. Well, gentlemen, is it not the time to give in to such terrible principles that what the government says is right? That's not true. In Bologna, for the last 900 years, always, in any civilized region of the world, there has been taught that just laws have to be obeyed. And then is the split. What to do with unjust laws? There has always been agreement, gentlemen, that unjust laws may be resisted. There has not been agreement whether unjust laws must be resisted. You see, when Mr. Hitler organized the extirpation of 6 million Jews in Auschwitz, and the orders were given, many of the Germans disagreed and disapproved, certainly, and they obeyed orders, never doubting that the law was unjust. But they held the view, which you also hold, that it is on the safer side to obey orders. And that unjust orders may be obeyed. So you see, we have in the Middle Ages, as I said already in 1180, two schools of thought. Both were no longer pagan. In a pagan tradition, laws have to be obeyed. The emperor, the king, the president, you see, the select man, the consul, orders, you have no faith. That's pagan. In the Christian era, gentlemen, there is no doubt that everyone in his conscience has to state whether this law is just or unjust. That's your privilege. But there will always be two schools of thought. There you have a typical struggle, you see, of a university rank. And in every one case, it has to be fought out again. Must you obey? Must you resist unjust law? Or may you resist unjust law? Will you take this down, gentlemen? Pain and solution, you obey. Law. The law is the law. And if you don't obey, they get you and put you in prison. Because of resistance, that's the law. Not so today, gentlemen. If the law is unjust,
There are, will always be two schools of thought, and I hope they'll always exist in this country, because only as long as both can be taught freely will we have freedom in America.
One will say, if the state does wrong, you have to resist. That was done by the abolitionists, and so with that the Civil War. But Lincoln said, as you say no to the last minute, you may resist, but you must not resist. That was the case of the Union against the secessionists, you see. Only when the North South seceded, did it positively wrong, you see, and could no longer be tolerated. You see, the three parties, they fear about it. Slavery was wrong. There was no doubt about it. And who had written on John Quincy Adams? Well, you know how eloquent he was on this point. But he said it may be tolerated. He did not incite to immediate rebellion. The abolitionist says it may not be obeyed. The Civil War took place when the Adams, the Adams Party and the Abolitionist Party got together. And they got together because the South was stupid enough, you see, to do positive wrong. You see, by seceding. And at that moment, the people who said slavery is unjust, but it may be okay, you see, could join the people who had always said slavery is unjust and it may not be okay. That's the abolitionist. So you get a very great case in the United States in 1861 with regard to this medieval doctrine of and the immediate, and you and I have in each one case weighed the evidence whether we may resist or we must resist, you see, or we may obey or we may not obey. Can you see this? This is very serious, gentlemen, and this country is in a very bad way because we have at this moment, I assure you, no place in which it is left. You have the University of Indiana with 21,000 students and the University of Ann Arbor with 51,000 students. The masses, but you have no science of law. You have examinations with machinery. Yes, so, yes, so, yes, so. Caveats of knowledge we have today. But that has nothing to do with the decision, gentlemen, which has to be cultivated in every human heart. Whether he knows what he's doing, whether he has the power to stand up against 10 or 55 million people in this country and say, you're wrong, I'm not going to share this one. That has to be done, that has to be cultivated, that has to be educated into you. And it can only be done if both sides of such a decision are voicedly enacted, you see, and lived by living people. Now, this, let's have a break here. Of the two parties on the universals in the Middle Ages is a war between nominalists and realists. And that goes right through all the three types of medieval university, be it medicine, be it law, and be it divinity. And be it the fourth faculty which prepared the children of the medieval world to go there, the so-called faculty of arts and sciences, the faculty in which you are when you are in a college. So not graduate school, you see, in which you are the fourth faculty of the arts and sciences, also is hit by this problem of the universals. And it also was split in Paris, in Salerno, and in Bologna and all the imitating universities later on, Oxford, Padua, and Heidelberg, and Salamanca in Spain. Wherever you have universities, you would find that the professors, regardless of they were jurists or theologians or doctors, would group themselves into nominalists and realists. And it's not easy for you and me to get the hang of this battle,
And especially what you read in books or in handbooks and textbooks is just awful stuff. And I think it's more misleading than enlightening. The gist of the matter between nominalists and realists is the question whether when I call you a human being, or whether when you call me a professor, this is anything real. Is it just a nomen, just an arbitrary thing, as you call it? Let us call this arbitrary God, as a student wrote in one of his papers to me. Let us call this arbitrary God. God bless his soul, this poor boy's soul. He really was a nominalist. That is, he declared that even God was just a name. Gentlemen, if God is just a name, then there is no God. Nominalism transforms the names and the word into mere words, and the words into mere inventions of the arbitrary individual mind. And that's what you believe. You are all nominalists. And this is, in Greece, was called the reign of the sophists. The sophists said all words are wax noses. We invent words and we sell them to the public. Every advertising agent does this, every propagandist does this, as a radio commentator does this. We live today in a situation very much like the end of the Middle Ages, the end of any civilization, when the nomina are nothing but names. Hollow, smoke, inventions. Smoke screens, perhaps the best word for nominalists. Nominalists say that words are smoke screens behind which people can hide their real intention to exploit you. You know this from all the world today, that they try to exploit you by selling you great names. There's nothing behind it. The realists, gentlemen, are the naive people to which I unfortunately belong. When I receive the mail in the morning, I feel so satisfied with all the advertising which is in the mail that I want to order everything they recommend. I think it's just wonderful. And fortunately, I'm married, and so I cannot put in all those orders, because otherwise I would be bankrupt. But I'm still one of these psychological victims, you see, who believes that when a man says something, that might be so. It might be real. The name might stand for reality. I might still believe that when I hear the United States of America, this means a free country. It is a pure superstition, then, in the eyes of the nominalists. They say, let's debunk this. Just commercial interests is nothing but. Well, you see, we are all both, obviously, nominalists at times and realists at times. When you sing the national anthem, you are a realist. Because obviously you try to say something which you mean. And when you run away from some overdone advertising and say, no, they won't get me, I won't buy a ticket here, that's just old stuff, then you are a nominalist. And you say, there's nothing but empty words. So, gentlemen, the decision of when are we forced to use certain general terms is a deep religious question. Because it means, is man able, capable to come to grips with the truth? If all words are just words, gentlemen, then you know absolutely blind, deaf, and dumb. Because every word can then just be abused. And if on the other hand, every name is true, then obviously we are the dupes of everybody who is callous enough and impertinent enough to play on our nerves and on our prejudices, you see, and use these terms. So, again, it's as with the unjust law, very similar. In the Christian era, it cannot be as in China, where when you make the sign of the Father, the son just has to kneel down because he's forced to be, you see, patriarchal and to obey orders from his father. In the Christian era, we must distinguish.
At certain times, we misuse certain words with authority, with relevance. And at certain times, we must be free to criticize. Make this parallel very clear in your notes, gentlemen. Between the, that's why I brought up this under law business first. That you can understand the right of resistance, you see. But it's quite clear to you that you cannot resist everything, every law. You can only resist unjust law, you see? And then you must not resist, but you only may resist. You understand? So you have always three attitudes. The wise man, the seamless true gentleman of all terms of humanity, human society, because these terms are the laws of human behavior in a much wider realm than the law. If you are forced to say of a Frenchman, he is a human being. Therefore, despite the fact that he is a Frenchman, I have to be decent to him. You are in a tremendous decision at this moment, because no doubt he is a Frenchman. And you have every reason to believe that Frenchmen and Americans don't go together very well. They don't. Begins with plumbing and basket, as you know. Plumbing in France and plumbing in America just smells differently. And therefore, if you are satisfied with the nominal, with the realistic idea, this man is a Frenchman. I don't do him injustice. He wants to be a Frenchman. I'm an American, you see. We better keep apart. You're perfectly legitimate, aren't you? I mean, everything is in order. Most people act this way. Or take a white man in the South, he says, niggers, no objection, but I won't have anything to do with it. And you see, when I come down South and I tell a woman there that I have a friend who is a Negro, a respected doctor in the town, she gets up in the train and says, you traitor, and will not speak to me anymore, just because I have a black man as my friend. Now, here you see, again, this is law. That is the name there makes law to her, you see. The name she has, she's entitled to apply, and my name for the same man is a different name. It's my friend. And the racial issue doesn't enter. I can forget it. And she cannot call him friend because she has nothing, the poor woman, but the racial clash, which you see now in South Africa, how serious this was. They call it apartheid business there, you see, where the same Boers, as you know, Mr. Marlan and his group, they have missions, Christian missions at this moment, Dutch missions, Boerish missions, going strong among the black men. And at the same time, they have apartheid. The human soul is a very difficult, you see, fellow to deal with. These people do more for the Negro in there, from their own point of view, the highest point of view, from the missionary point of view, then the English people who are against apartheid and who are just exploiting the black industrial worker there in Johannesburg in the diamond mines, and therefore need him and therefore are against apartheid. It's a terribly complicated business. It all depends who comes first, which name in application to human beings. And this here is the central thing which today is not understood by the logicians in this country. Who has taken a course in logic? Only one. Let's hope for the rest. The gentlemen, modern semanticists and modern logicians have completely lost sight of the importance of the problems of universals, because they think that it deals only with things. For example, is it necessary to call uranium a metal or an element? That would be such a nomen that is a reality. Is it one of the 72 elements, you see, or is it not? That's, as you know, very practical today, with 235 and 239, as you may know. What do we call an element? With these isotopies, you see, what is an element? Are the isotopies special elements, or are they one element in two forms? There you have a typical problem of the universalist struggle. But
But in the Middle Ages, gentlemen, the struggle was much more real, and it is going to be much more real when we deal with Negroes and Jews and Japanese and Chinese and communists in the future. It is very small matter, as these Mr. Wittgensteins and these logicians and semantics now deal with elements, because the elements don't talk back. Uranium doesn't tell us their opinion about our behavior with regard to uranium, you see. They suffer quietly, these elements. But the Japanese are not going to suffer quietly all the time. They are very angry with us because of this hydrogen explosion, you remember? Because their fishermen converted, they take it out of us now, 9 years after Hiroshima, because their whole pent up disgust with America comes out and is complaining about the fishermen, it's all complaining about the bomb explosion of the 1945. That's what how the way nations take their revenge. And it's much more serious than the people in this country seem to realize. It is not that we exploded some bomb, but that they were the victims of the bomb explosion, which is now on the agenda in Japan at this moment. Now then, there you have the very interesting quantum universal problem. Are the Japanese our human brothers with regard to bomb explosion, or are they objects of our military strategy? Is it a baby in Japan an object of strategy, or is it a fellow man in warfare? I understand that Mr. Mumford talked about this problem in his Tuesday lecture. Who listened to him? Anybody going? Wasn't this his subject, that the civilians have been put on the side of the enemy simply, you see, and have ceased to be treated as our fellow men? And that's a question of universals. Because is the general expression object or enemy, you see, can it be extended to anybody arbitrary by one side? After all, when the Japanese entered the war, they assumed that we were Christians. They therefore assumed that we would not bomb a city wholesale. They put it right on this. That was the tacit understanding so far, you see, in warfare. Now, we invented something which could only say we could murder all the women and children, so we did. But that's a change in code. And we simply did it because we talked ourselves into our right to use the general term object or enemy for anybody living in the country of Japan. Didn't mean that's quite unheard of. Nobody in 1870 or 1865 thought this. You read on the Civil War, and you read about the chivalry between the North and the South. These were your cousins. Do you think that the step-grandson of General Washington, the man who had married his step-granddaughter, General Lee, was an enemy? Simply, he was both. He was an American, he was a brother, and he was a friend, and he was a rebel. And that was very complicated. And all these universals had to be balanced very carefully, and they were not arbitrary. It was the sacred duty of Abraham Lincoln, and it was a tragedy of his assassination, as you know, that this could not be carried through, that we got the carpetbaggers instead of a settlement of the Civil War. And so we had to wait for Governor Shivers and the year of the Lord 1952 before we got the end of the Civil War in this country. 90 years ago, 80 years. Because nobody suppressed the arbitrary use by the North of the term enemy for the Southern people. It is very serious, gentlemen. Universal is an application, will you take this down, gentlemen, of generalizations to parts of the creation in which we move. Now that's very easily handled in chemistry and in physics because there the things do not talk back. But with regard to God Almighty,
with regard to divinity and with regard to society, then it is terribly important, any such expression. When you say of somebody, dirty Jew, tell him and you make for civil war, you may think that the man doesn't listen in, but somehow he knows exactly how to speak behind his back. And this is a generalization. And in your company, it may just be seduced to say so. But that doesn't mean that you honor the devil's child by using this term, and that you are preparing a great catastrophe. And you are. These terms are, therefore, gentlemen, the real decisive decisions between you and the world in which you live. This is decided. Because you subsume part of the created universe under some rules you have established. You say, I meet a Frenchman, I call him a Frenchman. Wait. Is it right to call him a Frenchman? Isn't this already jeopardizing your unity? Do you meet him as a Frenchman, you say? Is this the best description? Couldn't you avoid calling him a Frenchman as long as you possibly can and say, call him George? As long as you call him George, you see, you may cease to be an American, and that may be very good for you. Because you make him cease to be a Frenchman. And so there is something third which you create at this moment, simply by suspending judgment, can you see this? And by allowing France and America to become relative instead of staying absolute. The struggle of the universe, gentlemen, is your whole decision about the relative and the absolute. If you use these generalizations, your little bit of vocabulary which you have inherited from the streets of your, you think how accidental the ways you call people with their nicknames. Think of all the races and nationalities, how they tease each other in the big cities, you see. And if you think how accidental that is, the group whose nickname you inherit and the nickname which they pin on you from the other side, you must understand that men must struggle against the accident of this universe. We always speak of the accident of birth, to have heard this expression. But that is not so accidental. Birth is not accidental. I think if your parents were in love with each other, it's not accidental. But the accidental thing which you really mean when you speak of accident of birth is the use of universals which you and the people you meet apply upon each other. That you are called an American, or that you are called a New Yorker, or that you are called a student, that's purely accidental. And that may help you terribly, because it gets you together with a group of bunch of fellows for which you have cannot be called responsible. You see, you did not pick this environment. You really mean, not even the accident of environment, I invite you to consider a third rule room. Neither is birth accident nor is environment accident. But the use of the general terms which you use for other people and which other people use for you, that is largely accident. Because you are not meant at all for whom you really are. I could give you a funny example of something that happened yesterday. I have rebelled against the typical intellectual all my life. I've always tried to act and not just to think. I have made my whole life, I could, if you told you my story, has been an attempt to make action and thought always be coincident. I've given up many promotions and careers because I did not want to be, so to speak, purely in the hot air of the intellectual life. And yet it happened to me that men of my have to respect as a great fellow. Because he was angry with me, I didn't help him in a thing where I thought it wasn't my business. I said, I have come to this country, I'm not an American citizen,
and you dream there of German restoration, I'm not going to do this. Very good. That angered with me and said, typical German intellectual. And I looked him over and said, the treaty has, I thought he had to confess. The treaty has, because it was the one thing I was pretty sure that I didn't deserve. And that was a universal. From his classification, you see, it was very simple. He was impatient with me because I didn't do his bidding, so to speak. And he wanted to say that as far as he knew the German intellectual, he would never act and always just write books. And now, in my case, this was so funny because, as I said, for the last 40 years, I've always paid cash and always furnished the goods and have left the school and the book writing for many decades and in order to get into action. And my resolve not to meddle with German politics was definitely legitimate because I feel I'm in this country now. You see, I've turned my back on German affairs. This wasn't my business. He lives in this country as long as I live now. And he has never ceased to be a German. And so he cannot understand that I'm not, you see, with him in German politics, you see, at this moment. But I got my university, you see. And it has, of course, in a way, finished our friendship, because I still respect the man, he's a very nice man, but I see that he doesn't see me. I mean, he has classified me, you see, under some generalization, and I'm no longer interested in myself. And as far as he sees me, you see, I don't want to be seen in this way, mind. Well, many of you will make many such experiences in your life. I mentioned only because it happened yesterday. And it was quite an eye-opener again, what such generalization, you see, can do to human relations. I and he no longer see eye to eye because he doesn't see me, but he has given me a birth within his Pullman car for all German intellectuals. I'm no longer interested in myself in as far as he knows me. Can you understand this? That is a typical universal. And the question arises, gentlemen, now with regard to the highest, with regard to the divine. How the names of God are necessary or arbitrary. We have three stages. The things, the dead things of physics and chemistry, of furniture, of the metals, of minerals, and can be called one way or the other. We have these artificial names for the elements, for example. They can't call. They can't be inserted. And therefore, in the last 400 years, the call of the universal has been silence. The call of the universal always becomes very violent when human beings are in jeopardy. And then the question is a man really labeled right when instead of giving him an immortal soul and calling him my brother, to call him by his racial name, or by his religious name, you see, or by his age group? Is it not terrible for a church to have middle-aged couples and young married couples and the teenagers together for religious activities? Isn't this a devil incarnate? How we run our churches? I think it is a devil incarnate. It's a wrong universal applied by our church organization. They are crazy because they do not teach people to meet despite their different ages, but they teach them to meet because of their same ages. Well, that's no religious reason. That's a physiological reason or biological reason. And then you can have a tennis club much better for the young and a bridge club for the old. And call it a spade and don't call it a church. This is typical for wrong universal. Or indifferent, I mean, not thought out universal. But now with regard to God, in the Middle Ages, of course, we began with theology, they are much more touchy. And I have to try to get your interest awake by showing you that our problem of universals comes by the mutual use of name calling. When you are allowed to speak to somebody in one way and to speak of it behind his back in another way, then the question of universals becomes violently political at this moment in this country. Fair employment practice, for example. Let me go on. I'm only the short one. Gentlemen, all the medieval students and teachers were priests. And they all said mass every morning. Anselm of Canterbury and Abelard, the great founders of medieval thinking, were religious leaders. And they invoked God. To them it was a question of life and death, whether they invoked by their name the real power, or whether this was just sham fiction. They could not, for the life of them, ever admit, gentlemen, that nominalism solved any problem. You must look through the terror of sophistry, which is your curse, because you actually believe that words are just words. Gentlemen, even a doctor today has to call a typhoid fever a typhoid fever. He cannot back out and say that's just a word. If you pin him down, he has to say this is appendicitis. Because that means that his fellow doctor, to only convince this man in the hospital, has to operate on him. Therefore, the word appendicitis is a universal, which is, what is it? It teaches you, like, into a organism solution, which is at this moment necessary. The right universal is not saying that any name can be used always. It cannot say that no name can be used ever. It's as with the endoscope. The right universal of a doctor, for example, is that according to the state of science at this time and juncture of civilization, we have to call this case appendicitis, to the best of our knowledge. By our knowledge and conscience, we are forced to give it this name. Gentlemen, arbitrating the problem of generalization main enters the decisions of the historical hour. That's not a classroom decision. That's not something arbitrary. You cannot say which are arbitrary, quote unquote. For 954 years, people have spoken of the power that has been represented by Jesus as his father and of him as his son, and of the spirit that has emanated from this union as the Holy Spirit. And you cannot say what I arbitrarily call God, because that is an historical reality which, at this moment, in our Christian era, has to be said. You cannot back out of it. If you can, you can enter before silence, but you cannot speak at all. The only way in which you can speak of God is as a triune God. There is no other way of defining God. Because in this hour of history, this is the power which makes us speak to each other. And there is before, so was the father of the God of Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac, as you well know. And there are many ways of speaking of God as the creator of the universe. The gentleman, a man who says what I arbitrarily call God is an idiot. He's feeble-minded. He doesn't know what he's doing. Because, gentlemen, you have to invoke the mercy of God that you are in constant prison camp and are in the process of being poisoned by gas in our house. And then you are Mr. Dickinson now in court. Or when you are like Mr. General, what was the general, in the hands of the Russians. You are idiots, because you do not admit that you are living by the grace of God. And you have to invoke this grace in the ear of cruel men. And you have to rely on this. But you are too great apes of the marketplace. They ever told me, you think you sit and think out some God
which you paint, no gentleman. The power that gives you the power to resist evil, that's God. And we have learned how to resist evil by one great example and no other. So, gentlemen, the question for the medieval men was the question of the existence of speech, the existence of thought, the existence of philosophy and theology, all told. The question of the universals is the question whether man is a sophist, an advertising man who can say what he pleases, or whether he is an honest man who has to tell the truth. And it begins, of course, with the guarantor of truth. There is no truth if there is no God, because God is truth. You can't get out of it. So the whole blessing, sponsorship, authority, continuation of the whole life project of the Western world and the white man and the human race in general, by the way, has a little to do with the white man, but it's all everybody. Has to do very much with the restoration of the authority of the universe. It is perfectly true, gentlemen, that we have learned to speak of God in the right terms through Christ. That is, the cavemen did not yet know how to invoke God. So I take care of your tender conscience, that after all, not all people have always known God. And therefore you defend, you see, you prohibit yourself the use of God because it's just not scientific. It should be by all everybody. That's nonsense. Universals are used by the expert. Appendicitis is not something Johnny must know when he has appendicitis. That's the doctor must know. If you are a priest, an elder of the community, you must know that God has to be invoked by his proper name. As Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. If you are a child, if you are just Johnny and have a appendicitis, you don't have to speak of God, of course. You remember our tripartition of the human being. As a child, you can, of course, fend off your responsibility. I'm a playboy, I know nothing, of course. Very welcome. You don't belong to the university. As a fighter, you can fight the police and can say these terrible people in Rome or in Wittenberg or in Geneva, they are such Puritans, I have nothing to do with them. It's better to say I don't know them, of course. I don't use this term. It's a term that in my universal vocabulary doesn't exist. But gentlemen, if you are an elder in your heart of heart, if you know that you have to teach your wife and your child, that you are not going to run away from your wife, if you want to assure your wife that you respect marriage as a sacrament, you have to tell her that you believe in God. I have a friend who was a farmer, a Darwinist graduate, and a communist, and rich society. It was four things that you really cannot be very well altogether. He married a very pretty girl, and he sent her in 1936 on the route in Vermont to campus for her daughter, for Freddie. And she responded by running away with another Darwinist boy and getting a divorce. And since he was a communist, he had no way to say to her, to let him say to her, you're right, because you were to be. And he was very sorry, because he thought he had been married. But he could not invoke any name that burned her and him, in whose name this marriage was to stand. They were just two different bodies, and they had arbitrarily caused their living figures of marriage, and now it was all over in the eyes of the lady, and off she went with another boy. And this happens when you declare, gentlemen, that nay nomina are just words. You cannot get married. You cannot become a citizen of the United States. For example, you cannot invoke against the McCann Act your right as a citizen that you cannot be deported. As you know, they cancel it now in your naturalization, which is certainly right and justice. But in an irreligious country, you have no right to refer to God and to his faith and to say, once a citizen, always a citizen. That's bad faith. What faith they say? You have denied faith. You say faith. You're absolutely ignorant of faith. Faith is arbitrary. Everybody has his own faith. tribal. Without religion, you can't have the civil rights state. Without invoking God's majesty, you can have no ministry of justice, no administration of justice, no administration of anything in this country. But you believe it. And that's why we live today in a terrible age of sophistry. You actually believe that you can agree on what can't abide, but you cannot agree on the existence of God. Well, obviously, very soon, they steal your power. Because what's the difference between sex and property? If there's no God, there's no difference. Absolutely no difference. Totally arbitrary. It is only if your God is sanctified as an expression of the divine truth that I have to believe you. If you say that you say this in the name of truth, I've done acquiesce, you see, as it is to be. But if you say I have no, I speak in my own name, I say your own name, you dirty 100 pounds of flesh, I don't believe in your carnal name at all. Because you're just a bundle of nerves and of lust and of appetites, and I better run away from you, you're a dangerous man. And your reason, that's the harlot that serves your own thing for profit and your utility. You're just a utility. You must see this abyss yet in order to understand the importance of the problem of the universe. The problem of the universe becomes more and more urgent the higher up you come to the topic it covers. If we treat of truth and liberty and God and justice, then it's terribly important that we do not speak arbitrarily. If we speak of things, of dead things, it is more or less indifferent. Whether you call helium helium or whether you call it selenium, after all, we won't go to war for that, you see. Because that is an agreement between parties, you see, and the selenium and the helium and the oxygen and the hydrogen, they probably are not very interested in our vocabulary. So now you live in a world, gentlemen, from 1500 to 950, in which things have to be named. The little people live in a world in which divine powers had to be named. Justice, the church, the state, the courts, the families, the nations, the gods of the various religions at war with each other, the sects, the orthodox. That was the problem. Today, gentlemen, we have civil war all over the world, from Vietnam to Vietnam. You can't then say that's everywhere. That is Korea. Take North Korea and South Korea. Take Germany, East Germany and West Germany. Take Vietnam and Vietnam. Is it terrible? The allegedly unified nations are cut to pieces everywhere. Pakistan, India, similar tragedies. Ridiculous is division, of course. Pure invention of a civil war, you see. Man is today, therefore, waking up to a new problem of universes. How do we call each other? Now, gentlemen, this is why the medieval university has much more future than the modern Renaissance Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton. That's quite obsolete. That's just for physicists. Who cares for physicists? They just have to be in prison, incarcerated, or kept under control. We need, obviously, very different people to make peace in this world. Can't do it with physicists. So, gentlemen, the universes are not understood as a serious problem for the last 450 years. At this very moment, they are shooting forward because we discover now that general terms, generalizations have three applications, three different applications. One is, we invoke them.
in prayer. The second, we speak of things in general terms. We say there are 60 million countries, 40 million countries, 180, 90 million Russians. We all say this to briefly. As though there were just things, you can number. But then we come to men in mutuality and we speak to each other. There are three ways then of having general terms. Speaking to each other, you call me teacher, then I have to call, or I have to call you student. So mutually we invoke, give each other a general term. You call me old, I call you young. And as I told you my story, so he calls me a typical German intellectual. My revenge will be that I sign all my letters from now on, you see. T-D-I, typical German intellectual. I'm not allowed to forget his attack, his slander. You see, the things are called by general terms without repanza, without their answering. They are talked of, spoken of. People speak to each other, and the name you give me is reflected on the in the name I give you. As it, sounds into the woods, so the echo comes back. You have the program of this cantat in English? I mean, the echo, if you call me professor, I'm going to call you sir, too. And the universes are mutual among human beings. They are arbitrary about things. And we are of necessity with regard to the powers under whose guidance we must be placed in order to speak to each other at all. Before you can call me professor and I call you student, we must already be on speaking terms. The powers that make people live on speaking terms are the powers of the medieval universities. They are God. God is the power in whose name men people can speak to each other. And you must learn, gentlemen, that about the universes, with regard to the divinity, there can be no good. That's not arbitrary. If you think that is arbitrary, you thereby stop all intercourse and condemn man to eternal warfare. You don't believe this. I know, because you are practical people, and you think that in this country of ours, which has been blessed by a long time of peace, that you just can talk. That you don't believe that the basis is there. If you all believe in the same destiny of men, you believe in human liberty. And liberty is a guarantee which is only possible if God created you. Because, gentlemen, if your liberty is just like the liberty of a crocodile or of a basilisk or of a dragon, I dare say you. You see, when you say that you were created free and equal, you always assume that I have to believe that you were not created free as my enemy. That you were free for a higher purpose which I have to stop. Your freedom must be considered as a message to you. As soon as you are just free like a wild animal, I better take a pistol and shoot you. So you always think that when you say all men are born free and equal, that's a issue. And behind this sentence is always a religious free. That God wanted you to be free, and that I have to put up with your freedom whether I like it or not. I have not to put up with the freedom of the moose, you see, of the white bear. I can shoot it. I cannot shoot you. Why? Because God did not create you free and equal. But he created one man, of which you and I are just problematic. It is much more problematic. God has not created you and has not created me.
It's not true that God created men, women, people. That is just the secular translation of the Bible in which you said that God created Adam. That is, he created one man out of whom you and I have sprung. And the real tradition of the human race cannot be replaced by such naive statistical slogans that he created God, man, free and equal. And the whole story is that I have to put up with your stupidity and your tardiness and your laziness, and you have to put up with mine. Because we are just one, you see, it's the same person, divided into so many individuals. Is that true? I mean, it's much more serious, gentlemen, and it is no time out of sugar. I want you to know that the question of the universe is the question of the condition of human things. A very serious question. Even if today, in the time of the sophists, which says that any generalization is arbitrary. I call this man, I call this man a rational animal, that's also pleasant for you, see. And I say that any sociological textbook will tell you that it corresponds in schools and in students quite arbitrary. And as I said, students write in papers for me, whom we call arbitrary God. Gentlemen, if this is true, then go home. And don't pay 1 cent for any institution of higher learning. Can I make this? Can I make this? And I have not. And please go home and ask students that haven't believed this all these years. That's the teaching, the damn destruction of teaching that has gone in this country for the last 30 years. Then everything in human mind says is just arbitrary. Gentlemen, you know very well that it is, you cannot say to your captain on the battlefield, you are a coward, unless he is a coward. That's not arbitrary. The same way you cannot say to God that he is arbitrary, that you call him arbitrary, and God tap him on the shoulder. It's as though you would call your captain a coward. The father of our Lord Jesus Christ is not a coward. And he is not arbitrarily called God by you, to be sure. Thank you.